Aristotle, Apprehension, Predication, and Deduction. Now, this is the introduction to Thomistic epistemology, to understand what Aquinas means and all the terms that Aquinas uses. You must understand Aristotle because of the terminology. And if you're not familiar with these terms, they can really throw you a curve. To understand Aquinas, you have to understand the three acts of the intellect. The first act of the intellect is apprehension, the second act is predication, and the third act is deduction. Apprehension means the understanding of a thing, object, etc. Apprehension involves the following things. The subject of apprehension, a rational animal, by the first act of the intellect. The object of apprehension is an essence or a form of a thing. The method of apprehension is abstraction of the universal from the particulars. Example, you look at five or six particular human beings, and you abstract what they all have in common, and you get their essence. You see, one is short and one is tall. That's not part of their essence. You see, they're all rational. That's part of their essence. And so by abstraction, you're able to come to the essence of something by looking at various particulars. Get to that in detail a little more later. Then fourthly, there are the modes of apprehension. These are called the predicaments. The predicaments are not to be confused with the predicables, which we'll get to later. This will be worse than what was the guy in chapel the other day? The tertiary Byzantine contributions. The predicaments are the categories. According to Aristotle, there is substance and nine accidents. So the first category is substance. That's what something is. Subject of apprehension, which he distinguishes into two categories, primary substance, the ultimate subject of all predications, namely an individual, or secondary substance, the predicable of everything in a class or universal. But besides substance, what something is, you can talk about that thing in nine different ways, according to quantity, quality, relation, action, passion, place, time, position, or habit. You can ask this question about any substance or subject. How much, that's quantity, of the subject is being apprehended? Or you can ask the quality question about a subject or individual. What kind of subject is apprehended? You might want to know the relation of that subject. To what does the subject have reference? Or you might want to know the action. On what is the subject acting? Paul is throwing a ball on the wall. The passion, from what is it receiving the action? The ball is bouncing back to him. The place, where is the subject apprehended to be? In the backyard, say. When? 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that's time. Position, under what circumstances is the subject apprehended? What are the conditions surrounding this? Or 10, which is the ninth accident or category. The habit or state, in what condition is the subject apprehended to be? Now, this is a special category. Habit is natural, but not essential to a thing. By habit, he means clothes to a man or shodding to a horse. It's natural for humans to have clothes, but not essential. You're still human when you're naked. It's natural to shod a horse, but it's not essential. You're still a horse when you're not shod. According to Aristotle, Aquinas follows this, there are then these 10 modes of apprehension. You can think about, apprehend, get in your mind any individual or substance in 10 different categories. You can think about its substance, its whatness, or you can ask how much, what kind, to what, on what, from what, where, when, under what circumstances, or in what condition do you find it. That's the first act of the intellect, called understanding or apprehension. So you can apply this to a stone. You can apply this to a vegetable, a stone, a human being. We're not talking about an individual necessarily as a rational individual. He thinks that here are the categories of thought. For Aristotle, if he were a Kantian, he would say, you're born with these categories. This is how you just think about everything. Everybody has 10 categories. You reduce. How did he get them? by a transcendental reduction. If Kant were around, you just look at everything that's going on. This is what makes Aristotle so brilliant. When you think, he's the first guy to make this list. All he did is think and reflect and observe, and he reduced all of the ways that you can think about something to 10. Only 10 basic ways. You can think about its whatness, you can think about its how muchness, its what kindness, its to whatness, its on whatness, its from whatness, its whereness, its whenness, its under what circumstanceness, and in what conditionness. That's first act of the intellect. The mind has the ability to do that. Second act of the intellect, the mind, is called predication. That is a declaration or assertion about a thing, object, etc. And here, we have to talk about the subject of predication, and the subject of predication, the only thing that can make predications, judgments, connect predicates and subjects. And you all know what I mean when I say connect predicates and subjects. So I'm talking logically, I'm talking about S is P. S is P, or the tree is green. Logically, green is a predicate, tree is the subject, and the is the connective called the copula. So the only kind of being that can make predications of a subject are rational beings. Tree is green. Mary is kind. The subject of predication is a rational animal. That's how he defines man, Aristotle, a rational animal. By the second act of the intellect can apprehend things and it can make predications. The object of predication is an essence, form, or quiddity. That may be a new term to you. Quiddity just means an essence as related to a mind. And you might want to do this. Quiddity, nature, essence, and substance all refer to the same thing. Ontologically, there's no difference in these terms. Quiddity is, let's call it the whatness. These all have to do with whatness. A quiddity is whatness related to a mind. Nature is whatness related to operations or activities. Essence is whatness related to existence. And substance is usually whatness related to accidents, or as opposed to accidents. That is, the substance is what you are essentially, and accidents are what you have accidentally. So substance, if you were talking about whatness related to accidents, you'd call it a substance. If you're talking about whatness related to existence, you would call it essence. If you're talking about whatness related to the activity of something, you'd call it a nature. If you're talking about whatness related to a mind, you'd call it a quiddity. Part of the language game they play. That's the Aristotelian Thomistic language game. Those are the words. However, they have that same heritage in Western thought and are still used that way roughly today, although they're used more interchangeably. Okay, back to Roman numeral 2. Predication then is a declaration or assertion about a thing, an object. The subject of predication is a rational man. The object is an essence, form, or quiddity. And the purpose of a predication is to define the nature of a thing. That's the purpose for making a judgment about it, to get at what it is, define its nature. The predicables, the modes of predication, according to Aristotle, that is the ways a predicate may be predicated of a subject. You can predicate according to the genus when the predicate gives you the characteristic common to many. So if we were defining man and you predicated man according to his genus, that which is common to many, man belongs to the same class, you would say man is an animal because he belongs to the class of animals. According to Aristotle, and Aquinas would agree. If you use the predication rational, you are predicating according to the specific difference man has from the other animals. Man is a rational animal, and there are no other rational animals. When the predicate gives the characteristic distinctive of it. So if you said man is rational, you would be predicating according to specific difference. If you said man is animal, you'd be predicating according to genus. If you said man is a rational animal, then you would be predicating according to the species, because that's the very definition of man. He is a rational animal. And the predicate gives both, namely the whole definition, both the genus and the specific difference together, equals the species, or the very definition. If you said man has risibility, you would be predicating of man according to a property. And a property is when the predicate gives what flows from the essence but isn't part of the essence. Now, risibility means the ability to laugh. And if you said man has risibility, or man is risible, you're not giving his essence. He's not essentially a laughing being. But it's not accidental to man either. It's not just an accident. It's something that flows from his essence. If you're a rational being, you can be a humorous being, because only laughing hyenas notwithstanding, only rational beings can laugh. Because if you don't have a sense of the incongruity, see, the basis of all laughter is a sense of the incongruous. Incongruous is where the congressmen spend all their time. See, we all have a sense of risibility here, just proving the point. So if you give risibility, you are saying man is a rational being because flowing from that rationality is his ability to laugh. It's not accidental to him that he can laugh, and it's not essential to man that he can laugh. It's a property, and property flows from the essence but is not part of the essence. It's not accidental to the essence. A property is halfway between an accident. An accident is you're tall, or you're white, or you're black, or you're red. That's color is accidental to your humanness. Tallness is accidental to your humanness. But rationality is not accidental. That's essential to your humanness. Risibility is a property that flows from your essence, but is not your essence, nor is it an accident. If you say man is white, you are making a predication according to accidents. That's accidental to a human, what color they are. When the predicate gives what inheres in the essence, but is not part of the essence. Because the essence of man is a rational animal, and white, red and yellow, black and white, simply accidental. Now, that happens to deal with the modes of predication, or the predicables, five different modes of or ways of saying a predicate about a subject. The next is quantity and quality under predication. Quantity or extent of predication, every proposition is either universal or particular. A universal proposition means all in its class. All men are rational. Anything less than all is particular, and it's generally designated as some. Some men are fat. So that a universal proposition would cover all in its class, a particular proposition would cover less than all. Even if it happened to be most, many, or some, it's still less than all. Then you can make predication according to quality. And that would be either affirmative or negative. You either affirming something, all men are rational, or all men are not irrational. You're affirming or denying. So the quality of your predication has to do with whether it's affirmative or negative, the quantity, whether it's universal or particular, and the mode, whether it's giving the genus as animal, specific difference as rational, species as rational animal, property as risibility, or accidents as white. That's the second act of the intellect. The first act of the intellect is apprehension. Second act is predication in the modes we just discussed. The third act of the intellect has to do with syllogisms, where we make valid deductions or inferences about things. There's deductive logic, inductive logic, and fallacious logic, and Aristotle writes on all of these. Deductive logic, formal logic, deals with validity. It deals with deductions, and this is called prior analytics. Aristotle wrote a book on prior analytics, and Aquinas wrote a commentary on Aristotle's prior analytics. Material logic deals with truth, not just validity. See, even stupid syllogisms can be valid. I mean, if all men are purple and John is a man, then John is purple. That's valid. That follows validly from those premises, even though it's false. So validity has only to do with the formal inference. Granted, the premises are true, the conclusion follows validly and would be true. But if the premises are false, the conclusion just follows validly, but it could be false. So formal logic deals with validity. Material logic deals with truth. This deals with actual demonstrations. Give me a couple of true premises. Like, all men are rational. Socrates is a man. I can give you a true conclusion. Socrates is rational. That's posterior analytics of Aristotle and Aquinas' commentary on it. Then there's another kind of logic called inductive logic that deals with opinions. Now, the word opinion in the ancient world was stronger than it is today. It meant probable reasoning rather than demonstrable reasoning. If all men are rational and Socrates is a man, then that's demonstrable reasoning that Socrates is rational. That's proven. But inductive logic, where you're making observation and extrapolations and probabilities, is called opinion. Deals with probable reasoning, induction, and that's called the topics. Aristotle's book, The Topics. The third kind, fallacious logic, invalid and false, deals with incorrect reasoning, called sophistical refutations by Aristotle and Aquinas. And these books still stand as classics in the field, in spite of the fact they're written 400 B.C. and they're, going on 2,400 years old. They're still the classics in the field, written by Aristotle, and he's the first to ever put this together. That's why I have almost a sense of awe for a mind like Aristotle's. When the guy was the first to do it, he wrote the books, and they still stand as the classics in the field, never really been surpassed by, added to and modified by others, but never been surpassed since. That's a great intellectual giant. Aquinas took this material, and he wrote commentaries on it. Now, Aquinas' own epistemology, to which we turn now, basically took Aristotle's categories, Aristotle's logic, and he put his own particular Christian understanding to this, and we'd like to discuss that in some detail. The sources for Thomistic epistemology, the primary sources are his commentary on Aristotle's De Anima, about the soul, the commentary in Aristotle's Posterior Analytics, commentary in Aristotle's On Interpretation, one of the great books on hermeneutics ever written, which really saved the Reformation, incidentally, when Luther decided not to go allegorical Platonic, but to go Aristotelian and save the Reformation. Aquinas' book Summa Theologica, especially 116, 158, and 177 through 79, and 187, and then Aquinas on Truth, 814 and 108, would be some good primary sources for Thomistic epistemology. Some good secondary sources, Brennan, R.E. Brennan's book, Thomistic Psychology, that's the old classic called the Essentialist View, which we'll talk more about later, as opposed to the existential interpretation of Aquinas. One of the best, in my opinion, is Regis, R-E-G-I-S, Epistemology, good systematic treatise based on the text from Aquinas. He's actually interpreting texts. He'll give you his text and interpret them. He's trying to be faithful to Aquinas. Jacques Maritain is probably the most popular book and the most readable, and if you want something exciting and readable and up-to-date and Thomistic, you just get the flavor from reading any of Maritain's books. This one's called The Degrees of Knowledge, a Neo-Thomistic Existential View of Aquinas, in which he stresses that Aquinas believed that existence was prior to essence, which is the heart of existentialism, and he claims that Aquinas was the first modern existentialist, and the Neo-Thomists are distinguished by this existential interpretation of Aquinas. We'll have more to say about that when we deal with his metaphysics. Then Williamson, who teaches over here at University of Dallas, F.D. Williamson, Man's Knowledge of Reality. He stresses critical realism and the role of the judgment, the second act of the intellect. And there are two things about post-Kantian Thomist. Post-Kantian Thomist went from a more basic realism that man can know the real world to what's called a critical realism, where they had to defend that because Kant had built this gulf, said you can't know the real world. Then after Kant, the Thomists say, well, you can, and here's how you do, and they become more defensive and more critical in their view than they were before Kant. And then Van Wright, Thomistic Epistemology, a historical study of Thomistic epistemology. That's probably the classic historical work on the topic. So there are some sources, primary and secondary. Let's take a look at the Thomistic theory of knowledge itself. It can be divided into powers of sensation, powers of intellection, the object of intellection, and the nature of knowledge, and the process of knowing. Those are the main points we want to talk about. Let's talk about, first of all, the powers of sensation. Aquinas believes that everything that's in the mind first began in the senses, except the mind itself. The power of sensation, a power equals an accident or property of man, not his essence. A power is more like a property, it's more like risibility. It's either a very important accident or a power. And man has the power of sensation. The first power is he has the power to receive images. There's a tree out there, and I have the power to have an image of a tree in my mind. So the power to receive images from a single object. The five single senses are sight, smell, touch, hearing, and taste. And each one has a proper object. The proper object of sight is color, so you have the ability to receive color. You also have the ability to receive odor. That's the proper object of the sense smell. You also have the power to touch, which is called the tactile power. This is the power that enables you to sense something that you're touching. The power of hearing, the proper object is sound, and the power of taste, the proper object is flavor. So your outer senses, called impressed species, receive this material, and they transmit it to your brain where it's stored, which are the inner senses, and we'll talk about that later, about the express species. So the impressed species are these outer objects. Think of something as purple out there. And that is impressing itself on you, and you have the power to receive it and transmit it to your brain where it can be restored, where it can be stored and used for later image making. The second power you have is the power to recognize objects and coordinate them. If you only had the power of sight or smell or touch or hearing or taste, and they were uncoordinated, you might smell something and see something but not know it was the same thing. But you have some sort of power to coordinate so that when I look at this red book and I feel it and I see it, I know that I'm seeing and feeling one and the same object. That power is called common sense by Aquinas, but it's so different from what we mean by common sense. It just means a unifying sense, an ability to unify what all your senses are bringing to you and recognize it as one and the same object. So it recognizes objects and coordinates them. Common sense, unifying ability. And this deals with movement, rest, number, shape, and size. All of those things. Movement involves at least two or more senses. Shape involves two or more senses. Size, number, and rest. And in order to do that, you have to have this common or unifying ability.
For another class last night, I was reading Casserum, and he said that sometimes in the 1700s they did the first eye operation, and this was a big topic of discussion, whether there is a common sense. And what they're trying to do is determine the man, if the man who was seen for the first time could identify the object, if a common object in the room that he had felt and knew from touch, and could identify them from sight without touching them.
That would tend to support the theory that there was some sort of unifying sense then.
That would support that there wasn't.
That there wasn't?
Yes.
Why? To support that there wasn't, you would have to show that he could do it from one sense. You'd have to show that he could do it from only one, because a unifying sense means that you need some sort of power in order to unify these two or more senses that are bringing you data about one and the same thing. I don't know anything about that experiment, and I'm not saying this is true right here, that this is everything Aquinas says is true on this. I'm just expounding it. But what I would say that they would have to do experimentally is they would have to show to disprove this aspect of his theory, they would have to show that you could do these things from one sense alone, and that you don't need two or more senses in order to do it.
Well, the thing is, if I see something that looks rough, I know from experience that if I touch it, it'll feel.
But how do you know that that's one and the same thing? How do you know that, say, I'm feeling the sharp edge of this desk, and I see it, and it looks pretty sharp. How do I know that that's one and the same thing? My sight is seeing it, and my finger is feeling it. How do I know it's one and the same thing? How do I know I'm not feeling something else unless I have some unifying sense to bring that together?
Well, the theorists say that things that look like that have always felt like that.
How do they know that?
There's a relationship between them.
Yeah, but
common sense people would say that there's something about the look of sharp and the feel of sharp that is one. Whereas the empiricists are saying, learned that.
Well, you did learn it. You know, you learned it by feeling, and you look at it, and it's got a pretty sharp angle there, you know, and it comes together, and it's not rounded at the corner. You do see that. But then you feel that. But something has to put those two together, that you're feeling and seeing one and the same thing. Because otherwise you could be feeling something else. You might be feeling something round, actually, and seeing something pointed. I mean, it just seems, I hate to use the word, common sense to me, that there is such a thing as a common sense. It just seems common sense that you would have to, because you're getting all these perceptions. Think of getting five different senses of the same thing. Think of smelling it, seeing it, hearing it, everything. Now, how do you know that there's an it there? And that what you smell, see, hear, taste, put it all in there, is one and the same thing. Somehow or other, when these perceptions are coming to you, something is coordinating them. That power, Aquinas calls common sense, unifying sense. That's all we want to do for now. I don't really care to carry that one any farther than that. It's not really that important. Thirdly, you have the ability to retain these images. You can receive an image, a color, odor, tactile, sound, flavor. You can recognize objects and coordinate them, and you can retain these, and the ability to retain them is called imagination. Imagination is not the same as memory. Imagination is simply the ability to retain and store these images. I see a tree. I close my eyes, and I still see that tree. So I must have stored it. Right? I see a red book. Close my eyes. I still see a red book. I stored it. Now, the next power that you have, besides receiving, recognizing, retaining, is the ability to recall what you stored. And as you know, that's a little different power because of final exams that have proven that to you over and over. It's a whole lot easier to store than it is to recall. And your passive knowledge is greater than your active knowledge, and your passive vocabulary is greater than your active vocabulary for this same reason. Retaining is one thing, recalling is another thing. I believe I retain about everything I ever read, but I don't recall everything I ever read. As somebody said, I have a photographic memory. It's overexposed and underdeveloped. So Aquinas would agree with that bit of risibility there that is shared. Retain these images is imagination. Recalling them is memory. Then you have the ability to relate these images to ends. This is called the cogitative ability. The cogitative or estimative. And Aquinas thinks that instinct fits in this category. That a dog, for example, is just animal by virtue of being an animal. A man has certain instinctive things that he shares with other animals, the ability to relate certain things to certain ends. Food and hunger, water and thirst. If you weren't able to do that, you'd die of thirst or die of hunger. If you weren't able to relate that need to that end and to go for it and try and get it, you wouldn't be able to survive. So we have the powers of sensation, which are five. Receive the image, recognize the image, retain it, recall it, and relate it. Or the single objects of sense, coordinate common sense, imagination, memory, and the cogitative or estimative abilities. Now, the next thing we want to talk about is the power of intellection. That's simply the power to sense. Now, when the mind gets all this stuff that you bring to it by your senses, the mind goes to work. And the first power is the power to represent the object without its material condition. Now, I'm looking at this green tree out the window. I close my eyes and I see the green tree. Now, obviously, that physical tree is not in my mind. What is in my mind? An abstract image of that physical tree. I can see it. My eyes are closed. I'm not looking at the tree. I see that green tree in my mind. What am I seeing? Whatever it is, call it what you want, I have the ability to abstract an image of that tree and represent it in my mind. That's the first power, which is the first act of the intellect, abstraction. And this is the impressed species, as Aquinas would call it. I can represent it in my mind without the material condition. So I have that ability to either affirm or deny objects that are represented in my mind to the external world. My third rational power, power of intellection, is reason. I have the ability to go from one proposition to another. This is called the third act of the intellect. Representation in the mind is the first act, relating or judgment is the second act, and reason is the third act, which is parallel to what we just went through in Aristotle. The third act of the intellect is the ability to make syllogistic conclusions or inferential conclusions from premises. Put two and two together and get four. All men are rational. Socrates is a man. Socrates is rational. All right, any question about the powers of sensation or the powers of intellection, which all total are eight? Receive, recognize, retain, recall, relate, represent in the mind, relate in the mind, reason about it. Five of them are powers of sensation and three of them are powers of intellection. Now, how does he know that? How did he come about this? You just observe and think and analyze yourself in the process and reduce it. You simply say, look, I do this, therefore I must have the power to do it. I do look at a tree, close my eyes and still see the tree, so I must have the power to do that. There's nothing magical about his epistemology. He's just taking the obvious. He's just looking at what he does do. I do make valid conclusions from premises, therefore I must have the power of syllogistic reasoning.
Where would you fit in the power to, for example, take that tree and to modify it in your mind, or to create something or invent something that's never been seen or made before?
Well, that would be a creative power. That would be a power of relate images to each other and to external objects. I gave only the external object illustration of it, but relating images to each other would be a creative power. Probably come.
Is this the analysis of our sensation that somewhat carry over to the empiricist?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. In other words, the modern empiricists, Locke, Berkeley, and Hume, are carryover from Aristotle and Aquinas. But what happened in the modern world was an increasing skepticism. See, whereas Aristotle / Aquinas believed that you could know the real world, and you could know the real world that existed out there, then after Kant, you can't know the real world. Everybody before Kant just assumed that Aristotle's realism was correct. That is, every realist assumed that the senses are truly bringing you representative images of the external world. And the empiricists came along and said, now wait a minute, are we knowing the external world through our images, imagination, sense images, or are we just knowing our images? And of course that raises immediately a skeptical question. And now skepticism becomes a live option because you said something that these people would never have thought of, and that is that we weren't knowing the real world through our images. We may just be knowing our images about the real world. And therefore, everyone after Kant has to be a critical realist because he has to answer that question. Yeah, that would be one thing a skeptic would use. When you have a deformed sense organ, or even others who are colorblind, or animals, some who are just naturally colorblind, aren't really seeing the same thing, so we can't make that characteristic a part of the real world. Is the color in the wall, or is the color in me? Is the wall really colored? Is it really the same color, or is it appears to be different colors to different people? Well, that kind of subjectivity in interpreting the external world led people to believe that you couldn't make the external world the objective criteria of everything because some of it seemed to be subjective and happened to do with the perceiver and not what was perceived. But let's not get into that right now because it's really not important to our story here or to the kind of direction that we want to go. I'm not particularly interested in that because it's a dead-end street and it's of no interest to doing theism, so I just soon pass on that and talk about the other two things in the bottom here. Let's talk about the object of intellection. The powers of sensation are five: receive, recognize, retain, recall, and relate. The powers of intellection are three: represent in the mind, the first act of the intellect, relate, make judgments about the second act, and reason, make inferences from the third act of the intellect. Now, the objects of intellection, the material object is being. The proper object is sensible being, and the formal object is intelligible being, the ratio entis. Now, let's distinguish between those three. They're very important. What is the object of knowing, which he calls the object of intellection? What is it that we're trying to know? Reality, being, theontos. So the material object of epistemology, of the knowing process, is reality or being. But the proper object is what he calls sensible being, because we know being only as we sense it. Say the tree is real out there, but I'm getting an image of the tree. So what is the proper object of that tree? It's that tree as sensed by me through the images I'm getting of that tree. So the proper object is the sensible being, the material composite. The formal object is what he calls a ratio entis, that is an intelligible being, being as known by me, being as perceived by my mind. The little rational entity, the little rational being, being as it exists in my mind as opposed to being as it exists in that tree. So the material object is being itself out there. The proper object is the sensible images I have of it, and the formal object is this intelligible being that is known in my mind called the ratio entis. The nature of knowledge. Knowledge is neither making nor receiving, but existing. Now, this is unique to Aquinas. For a rationalist, knowledge would be making. For a pure empiricist, knowledge would be receiving. For Aquinas, knowledge is neither making with the mind nor purely passively receiving with the senses. Knowledge is a kind of existing. That's why he's called an existentialist, or the first existentialist. To know is to become the other, or to become the object known, in an intentional way. To know the tree is to take on the tree in my mind. It's for me to become tree intentionally. And I don't mean by intentionally, purposefully. I mean to take the tree on in my intentions, in my mind. So when I know something, I become the other by taking it on, not literally and physically, but cogitatively, imaginatively, intentionally is the proper term. Knowing is neither making nor receiving, but existing. To know is to become the other in an intentional way. Thirdly, to know is to have being intentionally. That is, to have a representation of it in my mind, the image of that tree in my mind. When we know, we exist in a new way by taking on the other. This is high, you know, for 1300, 1200, 24 to 74, this is highly modern epistemology. This is existentialism, where I become the other, I know the other, I take on the other. This is not empiricism, pure and simple. This is not abstractionism. We are knowing through images. We're not knowing images for Aquinas. I know you, I take on you in an intentional way. You become part of me as I know you. So when we know, we exist in a new way. In knowing another, there is a dynamic relationship between the knower and the known. Not a static, not even a passive. My mind is reaching out, grabbing your essence, taking, abstracting that, because I can't get the real you inside me, abstracting that, taking a representation of it, and knowing it in my mind, part of me. Now the process of knowing, according to Aquinas, is we know that we know before we know how we know. Think of walking. You can walk before you know how you walk. You can talk before you know how to talk. Know how you talk, rather. You can walk before you know how walking is possible, and you can talk before you know how talking is possible. You don't have to study communication to be able to communicate. You don't have to study physiology to be able to walk. You don't have to study epistemology to be able to know. Thank God you can know without studying epistemology. So when we know, we exist in a new way, and when we know that something is true before we know how we know it is true. Before I ever studied philosophy, I knew being. I knew reality. How do I know reality is a question philosophers ask. It's not a question an ordinary man asks. An ordinary man just knows reality. When he hits head on into it, he knows it's real. Philosopher asks, how do I know it's real? That may be our first problem right there. But when you ask that, then you're engaged in formal epistemology. Before that, you're simply knowing. So the mind knows, according to Aquinas, that something is so before he knows how. Secondly, the mind knows only through sense knowledge, but it knows more than sense knowledge. That is, the data of sense has more in it than sense data. Now there's his answer to the modern Kantians. I'm not simply knowing sense data. I'm knowing reality through sense data. And what I know in sense data is more than sense data. Just take a look at any piece of paper in front of you. It's got data on it, right? Take one with lines and look at it and you say, What's on there? A, B, C, I see a lot of letters. I see punctuation points. Well, all that's on that page are 26 letters and punctuation points. There's no other data on that page. Oh, a few numbers. Throw in the numbers, too. 1 through 10. You got 1 through 9 and 0, 26 letters and punctuation points. Nothing else on the page. But when you look at that page, there's more than sense data there. What you're knowing through sense data is more than sense data. So Aquinas is just taking the obvious thing that you and I know meaning. We know meaning, and meaning is more than sense data. Reality is more than sense data. Reality is what you know through sense data, but the sense data is not what you know. Or take another illustration. As you're listening to my voice, you know more than sound. And you're getting more than sound. Maybe not much more at times, but from time to time, some mittance of truth emanates forth from my mind, and you pick it up and and record it in your mind, and later may even recall it. But what you're knowing is more than sound. What you're seeing is more than sense data. So all Aquinas is saying is the mind knows true sense knowledge, but it knows more than sense knowledge because the data of sense has more in it than sense data. This piece of paper in front of me has more on it than the alphabet and the numbers and punctuation points. It has information there. Thirdly, the medium of knowledge is what he calls species or likeness, a presentative form which makes present the object. Let's get back to our tree. How does it, when I close my eyes, how does that tree make itself present to me? A presentative form of that tree. My mind reaches out and takes on a presentative form in, and I know the tree in an intentional way. So the medium of knowledge is a species or likeness of that tree which presents itself as a form to my mind, makes itself present to me. And I reach out and I know what is being made present to me. Fourthly, in the process of knowing, the express species. Now the impressed species are from the senses, impressed upon us. The express species are what Aquinas calls a formal sign pointing to another. Not instrumental signs pointing from itself to another. That is the concept in the mind, the express species, or the concept that I have in my mind, isn't what is known, but it is that by which it is known. What I know is reality, but I know it through the concept. So the concept, which is the express species, expressed in my mind through a formal sign, points beyond itself to another. It doesn't point to itself, saying, know me. It points beyond itself, saying, know reality. And that express species, formal sign, is not an instrumental sign. It's the formal sign through which I know reality. The concept isn't what is known, but is that by which reality is known. All right, any question on the latter part of Aquinas, the powers of intellect or the object or nature of knowledge?
Yeah, I'm a little lost in nature of knowledge when he talks about knowing is existing, and know it's just become the other. It sounds a little spooky there. Normally, you just sound so common sense. I have a little thought with saying. I know what the other two are.
Yeah, you do literally become something when you don't physically become something, but you literally become something when you know it. If you truly know it, you take it on. If you take it on, it becomes part of you. If it becomes part of you, you have become it.
Now, what part of it have I taken on?
You've taken it on intentionally. You've taken it on, this is too weak a word, abstractly. You've taken on those images. And those images become part of you. And though, therefore you become...
Not its form, you might say.
You've taken on its form. That's exactly right. And that form then forms you. So you notice two people have been married for a long time and they begin to look more like each other? Even though physically they didn't look like each other to begin with, they actually do. What happened? By constant exposure and knowing the other, they take on the other and become the other. Now in a small way, everything you truly know makes you to become different. That's what he means. That's right. No, that's exactly right. People, I've seen that too. The world has gone to the dogs, literally. And a lot of people, they tend to look like, and their behavior too. Now, the dog is taking on some of the people's behavior, and I think it's reciprocal because most interactions are reciprocal relations where you're taking on some of them and they're taking on some of you. I think in some cases the dog is the loser.
I'm just not sure how this express thinking.
Yeah, the problem with Aquinas, that's why I tried to use common sense terms. You have a problem in communicating Aquinas. Either you learn a whole new set of terminology and become almost medieval and get into this very abstract terminology, or you use modern rough equivalents. The danger of using modern rough equivalents is you lose the precision of the understanding and you are open to misunderstanding of the view. I take that risk when I use them. But express species, look at the synonyms there, are formal signs or forms in the mind or concepts or representative forms or abstract forms. They're what I have in my mind when I abstract tree-ness from tree. When I close my eyes and I'm not seeing the tree and I abstract tree-ness and it's represented in my mind, that's the formal representation of it there in my mind. And if I truly know that tree, I've taken on, in some sense, the form of that tree.
Did Plato say the same thing, basically?
Well, yes and no. The reason I'm hedging is Plato's epistemology, he didn't start in the senses, but he did have forms. And he did believe that the forms in your mind corresponded to the forms in reality, but the difference between Plato and Aquinas is very, very important here. Here's Plato, and here's the real world over here, and the real world has all these forms, F1, F2, and F3. For Plato, when the mind takes on this form, that in your mind you have a form that directly corresponds to F1, you have F1 in your mind, and it's just as it's identical to F1 out there, just as identical as a ring making an imprint in wax. Your mind is the wax in this case, and that ring imprint is exact one-to-one correspondence between that ring, which would be the form out here. For Aquinas, that is not so. For Plato, there was a univocal relationship, exactly the same between the forms out there and the forms in the mind. For Aquinas, there is only an analogous relationship between the form out there and the form in your mind, because you can never know God, an infinite form, essence, being, with a one-to-one correspondence in a finite mind. You're going to have to know God by analogy. Now, you might know some things on the horizontal level, you know, form of a tree, one-to-one. That's a moot point in Aquinas as to whether all knowledge is analogous or just knowledge about God is analogous. But if some knowledge is univocal, it would have to be on the horizontal realm, the one-to-one correspondence. There is no one-to-one correspondence between my mind, the form in my mind, and the form in God's mind. Well, Aquinas, surprisingly enough, when you get into him, is far more existential than most people think in his theory of knowledge. Most people stereotype Aquinas as though he were David Hume, who thought you could know the real world and God. You know, tabula rasa, born a blank slate, everything is impressed on it, and you know things abstractly, scholastically, medievally, you know, all those pejorative terms are used. When he believed that you were really knowing reality and becoming that reality as you knew it, which is, and that you were in process, that you're a being in process and constantly becoming, you know, if you take Whitehead's view of God and bring it down on the level of Aquinas, on the level of man, Aquinas' view of man is very similar to Whitehead's view of God, a being that's becoming and constantly knowing and in process, except that Aquinas does have a part that is unchangeable there as well.
So that statement and some of the other analogical ones would be, you know, it's like the other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's why we say there that you have a likeness, you take on a likeness of the other. Obviously, you can't take on the other physically in your mind. You're only taking it on intentionally, and you're only taking it on probably analogously. I doubt seriously whether I'm taking on a one-to-one correspondence with the other in every respect in which I know the other. So I would think that you can make a good case for all knowledge being analogous, not simply a knowledge of God. But as I say, that's another story, another day.
How does the concept of being deceived work? When you think you're perceiving something that you're really not, and you're being deceived, I guess you're just becoming something that's not real.
You can be deceived because the senses are distorting the information and not properly transmitting, getting a bad signal. You can be deceived because you are jumping to a conclusion. You're so urgent in your knowledge for reality that you jump to a conclusion too soon. Remember, he gave several reasons or grounds for being deceived in the thing we went through on first principles there. It's quite different from the subjectivist, because in Aquinas' case, there is an objective reality out there which the mind is corresponding to. See, he believes in a correspondence view of truth and reality. So you have this objective reality out there which has objective forms, F1, 2, and 3, and the mind is getting an actual knowledge forms from and that correspond to. So the mind isn't creating the forms, or the mind isn't without forms, and reality isn't without forms. So you have a form-to-form correspondence, likeness, between your mind and reality. Where in a subjectivist, either there would be no forms out there, and or you create the forms yourself and superimpose them on reality out there, which is amorphous. It's like an amorphous lump of clay, and your mind creates, generates forms, and then you take what's in your mind and you project it on reality out there. Let's take a radical example like Sartre, where he said, "I am my books. I create meaning. There is no meaning out there in and of itself, but I am a form-generating being. I like to write. I like to draw. I like to paint. And I create all this meaning." So you're creating forms and putting it on the world. That would be a highly subjective view. Aquinas, you're not creating the forms. They are there in the real world, and the forms in your mind correspond to it. Indeed, you got the forms in your mind. That is the image of that tree, not the innate form that you're born with to know these. You got those forms or concepts from that object out there. That's how they got your mind to begin with. So it's really different than a subjectivist view. It's the opposite end of the pole.